Hi, everyone. So let me start by talking about the Muslim ban that President Trump ordered on January 27th. And I call it a Muslim ban deliberately. The first thing that you should note is the date. January 27th was exactly 1 week after Trump was inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States. It was an election result that surprised many. I was among, I think, a few people who thought he would beat Hillary, but I'm still, to this day, often surprised by the reality, even though I expected that that would be the result of the election. So January 27th, one week after he assumes power, is when he issues an executive order, and you'll see from the title of the executive order that it affects immigration, it affects the flow of refugees into the United States at a time of unprecedented crisis in different countries. But it does that in the name of security, right? It's protecting the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the United States. And so you'll find here the lexical field of American nationalism, of white nationalism specifically, and xenophobia. All of those things are present just from the title alone. Then when you focus in on one of the preambles of the executive order, its statement of purpose, really, you see very clearly that in the way that Trump conceives of the purpose of this policy, it is again about security. That's sort of the facial justification for this xenophobic and racist order that we're going to study in greater detail. And I'm going to come back to this in a second. This is one of the sort of most relevant operative provisions in the executive order, and I want to go through it a little bit with you. It targets both immigrants and non-immigrants. So in U.S. immigration law, you have, broadly speaking, two categories of visas. Immigrant visas for people who will eventually become permanent residents and ultimately citizens. Non-immigrant visas for tourists from countries that, unlike Germany, don't benefit from a visa waiver program for tourism. So like a Chinese national would have to apply for a tourist visa to come into the United States. So this executive order targets both immigrants and non-immigrant visa holders from countries that are listed in a statute. When you look at that statute, the countries are Iraq, Iran, Syria, Sudan, Somalia, Libya, and Yemen. So it's those seven countries. All of them are Muslim-majority countries. And another important thing they have in common is that they're all countries that the United States has bombed, or, in the case of Iran, that the United States, or at least some portions of the of decision-making circles in the United States, have an intention to bomb in the future. So you should... What you want to zero in on here is that you're targeting, the citizens of these countries, that most of which find themselves in an era of unprecedented crisis. So many refugees, as all of you know living in Germany, are flowing out of Syria, are flowing out of Iraq, are flowing out of Yemen, where there is an equally tragic conflict going on today that has not gotten anywhere near the level of media and public attention that it deserves. So these are some of the worst crises, these are the worst crises, humanitarian crises of our time, and the United States is closing the door to these people in their time of greatest need. This is where I want to go back to the previous section. The previous section says foreign nationals who intend to commit terrorist attacks in the United States. Right, so when you put those things together, what it means is that in the view of the president, in the view of Trump, nationals from these countries, from these seven countries, that it's fair to presume that nationals from these seven countries are more likely than others to engage in terrorist action that would threaten, the interests or the lives of U.S. citizens. So that's the logic here, that there's this supposition, there's this presupposition that nationals of these seven countries are more likely to engage in that form of criminality that has been labeled as terrorism than nationals of other countries. What the effective provision that you have up on the screen here does is that for 90 days, it suspends the entry of nationals from those countries. Now, those 90 days could be renewed for additional periods of 90 days. But that was the initial executive order. And I say initial because, you know, you can think of this as Muslim ban 1.0. And at this point, the executive order that we're looking at right now is no longer in effect. It has been replaced by a second executive order. You can think of that as Muslim ban 2.0. But the reason I want us all to talk about this one today is that, one, it states the intentions of the president in a very direct and clear way. Two, it's not, you know, significantly different from the second version that the president ordered, that the president issued on March 6th and which became effective on March 16th. So there are some important differences, but for the most part, the second order tries to do what the first order tried to do. And then the third reason I want to focus on this, what is now a historical document and not a current effective legal document, is because it enables me to tell a complete story, right? We can go through the full cycle with this historical document, and then at the end, I'll touch on where we are with the Muslim ban 2.0, the March 6th version of this order that became effective on March 16th. The other part of the executive order was this, a proclamation that the entry of Syrian nationals as refugees, of Syrian refugees, had to be suspended. You'll note here that there is no 90-day limitation. This is an open-ended, indefinite suspension of entry from refugees coming from Syria into the United States. It's not unprecedented, right? There are similar low points in the history of the United States, most notably in the World War II era when there were hundreds upon thousands of refugees, of Jewish refugees from Europe, trying to enter the United States. There was a similar shutdown back then. And there have been others historically as well, going back all the way to the Chinese Exclusion Act, where for a very long period of time, for almost half a century, Chinese nationals were not allowed to enter the United States. The other important part to focus on in this executive order is the suspension of the U.S. refugee program for 4 months. That is completely unprecedented. The last time that there was a suspension of the U.S. refugee program was after 9/11, and that was not for 120 days. That was for a shorter period of time. This is important. What this means is that no refugee from anywhere on earth can come to the United States. That's what Trump was trying to do, right? It doesn't matter if you're from Syria or from South Africa or from Kenya or from Guatemala. The program itself was suspended, which meant that the road for refugees to enter the United States had been closed off, or at least that was the president's intention. The other part of this that I want to highlight is this, the proclamation of a limit of 50,000 refugees for fiscal year 2017. 50,000 for a country of upwards of 350 million inhabitants is a negligible number. Obama had set the bar at 100,000, which itself was a negligible number, right? And so Trump comes in and tries to cut that down by 50%. We've seen that before under President Reagan. I would say that 100,000 to 50,000, I mean, it's really peanuts compared to the capacity of the United States, and I would say the duty and the responsibility of the United States to accept refugees. When I say duty and responsibility, it isn't simply because the United States is a so-called first world country like Germany and like other places. I think being a first world country means you have that responsibility. But there's also historical responsibility to the extent that a country has benefited materially from the troubles of the so-called developing world, then that means that country has a responsibility to pay the price for it in that way, to welcome refugees. When you think specifically about the United States and you look at countries that refugees are coming from, you look at Iraq, you look at Syria, you look at Yemen, those are all countries where, to the extent there's a humanitarian crisis today, the United States has played a central role in creating the circumstances that have led to that humanitarian crisis. ISIS, for example, would not exist had it not been for U.S. involvement in Iraq, for certain decisions that were made after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, specifically the decision to demilitarize, to de-Ba'athify Iraq, the decision to stand up vast military prisons, the decision to throw thousands and thousands of Iraqis into these military prisons and to mistreat them. There are a number of fundamental structural factors that were created by the United States in a place like Iraq that set the necessary conditions for the rise of ISIS. And so I think out of that mode of participation in the affairs of Western Asia, of what's called the Middle East, you know, comes a share of responsibility. To Syrians are leaving their homeland, Iraqis are leaving their homeland, Afghans are leaving their homeland in large part because of U.S. foreign policy. And I don't mean here to minimize the complicity of Germany and of the European Union. Of course, you know, the European Union is also complicit in what has befallen the people of those regions. So the so what is that? What has that meant for people? What you see up on screen here is a team of my students at the City University of New York Law School in a Know Your Rights workshop at a community in Brooklyn, an immigrant community in Brooklyn. After the executive order issued on January 27th, you know, we've always done Know Your Rights workshops since 2009, since I started the CLEAR project at CUNY Law School. My students and I have been in different community sites hundreds of times to do these workshops. And on average, we do one or two a week. But after the executive order, after the January 27th executive order, we've been doing one or two a day. Because the level of fear and concern in immigrant communities, not just Iraqi, Syrian, Somali communities, in Muslim communities more broadly, and in immigrant communities even more broadly, has been unprecedented. So we've had to do these workshops once or twice a day, where people are asking us questions about whether they can travel, whether they're ever going to see their loved ones overseas again, whether they're going to be able to bring you know, their wife, who's a refugee in a camp in Turkey, over to the United States. And those are the sorts of concerns we've had to address. We've also received an unprecedented number of calls from people from clients, from people we've represented. So in the 10 days that followed January 27th, that first executive order, we triaged over 200 cases, 200 new cases. We handled over 200 new cases of people who were overseas on their way in, literally in midair when the executive order issued, or were about to get on a plane, or were denied boarding, or were being interrogated, detained and interrogated at a point of entry like, you know, JFK Airport in New York. So here we are with here I am with a team of students at JFK a week after the executive order. We stayed there for a period of 3 days nonstop because we had 16 clients who were coming in from overseas. And some of these clients, by the way, were detained and questioned. I'll tell you the story of one of our Sudanese clients. She's a Sudanese citizen. She's in her 20s. She grew up in the United States, but she's a permanent resident. You know, she has a green card. She lives in the United States. That's where her life is. That's where her home is. She had gone overseas, and she was coming home. She landed at midnight, the day of the executive order. So the executive order was signed on that Friday afternoon, January 27th, and she landed a few hours after that. So this is her coming home to New York, to her own country, as a permanent resident. She's detained, she's handcuffed, her hands are put up against the wall, she's strip searched. The agents standing behind her are talking out loud about whether or not, under the new executive order, they have to conduct an anal cavity search. So she's hearing all of this. Thankfully, they decided not to do that, but they still humiliated her and held her for 7 hours. The whole time, you know, we were trying to make calls to officials at the airport. We ultimately threatened to sue, and they allowed her into the country. And the official said to me that was an exceptional, that he was making an exception for someone who's a permanent resident in the United States. We had a family of Syrian refugees. The husband had come in a few days earlier. The wife was coming in with her kids a few days later, and so her arrival was after the executive order. So she was held up at JFK in question. She was separated from her twin boys. Her twin boys are 4 years old. So the kids were separated from the mother. The kids were questioned. The mother was questioned separately. And so again, we had to put pressure to get them out. These are just a couple of the stories. Like I said, we had, you know, 16 different groups of clients coming in after the executive order, and there were hundreds of others in New York City and nationwide that, you know, our colleagues at different organizations handled. And there were a few large lawsuits that were brought in federal court. We threatened to sue, but we ended up not having to sue because our clients were released. But there were some cases where the people who were being detained and questioned at the airport were not released. And so some lawsuits were actually brought in federal court in New York. And there was a judge in New York, a federal judge in New York, and another federal judge in Oregon, out west, who stayed the executive order, which means that they froze the application of the executive order. And that was the first executive order. So at some point, the federal courts got involved and suspended the application of that order, which allowed people to come in more freely. We were back to where we were on January 26th, basically, before the executive order was passed. How did the White House react when that happened? I mean, even before the courts got involved, there was such a huge reaction on the street, people protesting, people coming to airports and staging sit-ins, civil disobedience, getting arrested. There was such a tremendous reaction from people on the street and from the media that the White House had to respond. And here's what, here's sort of a highlight, like an excerpt from that response. Because everyone was calling it a Muslim ban, because clearly it was, Trump felt obligated to issue this statement on January 29th, 2 days after the executive order passed, at a time when there were already thousands of people protesting at JFK, protesting in the streets, hundreds of lawyers like the team from CLEAR that you saw earlier, my students who were there on the ground. This is the statement that he releases where he says, you know, it's not a Muslim ban. Of course, you know, that's problematic when, you know, Trump hasn't exactly been silent. He's been all over Twitter, and it really isn't hard to find statements that contradict what he said as president. So if you go back to an earlier statement in 2015, he himself makes it very clear that it is about a shutdown of Muslims, right? And so, you know, the contradiction couldn't be more obvious. But you don't even have to go back that far. You don't even have to look at statements that he made in 2015 when he was a candidate. You can look, go back to the executive order itself, and this is what some of the lawyers who actually litigated in federal court did. There are provisions that clearly, you know, reveal even more clearly sort of the racist and xenophobic and Islamophobic nature of this executive order, like this provision here, which, you know, to translate that, what it means basically is we're going to prioritize Christians. We're not going to, you know, we're going to deprioritize Muslim applicants for refugee status, Muslim asylees, and we're going to prioritize Christians from Muslim-majority countries, right? That's what that means. And so, you know, rightly, the lawyers pointed to that to say, look, this is clearly about Muslims. It's clearly Islamophobic. And some of, you know, this statement, the other statement I showed you, and many other statements that Trump and his people had put out during their campaign and after they took power are what convinced the federal judges to put an end to the application of the first executive order. So what happened after that? There were appeals that were taken, but ultimately on March 6th, Trump decides to issue a new executive order that, you know, his lawyers have cleaned up a little bit. They've taken out some of the provisions. So the provision that says no Syrian refugees forever, basically, that was taken out. But the other provisions, the main one, which says, hey, nationals of these countries cannot come in for 90 days, that remains in there with one small modification. They've taken Iraq out of the list. So now it's six countries, not seven. Iraqis can come in. They're subject to extra screening, but they can come in, right? But the other six countries are still affected by Muslim ban 2.0. So what happened after that? That was also challenged in court, and very quickly a federal judge in Hawaii said, nationwide, you cannot apply this order. So that's where we are today. Muslim ban 2.0 was issued by Trump on March 6th. It's a cleaned up version of what we just talked about. It came into effect on March 16th, and a few days later, a federal judge in Hawaii said, you cannot apply this executive order until the case is over, until, you know, we've litigated it and we've looked at its legality, we've looked at its constitutionality. So right now, you know, there's, again, a tremendous amount of fear and concern in different communities, but the order itself is not being applied, at least not until a judge or that judge in Hawaii reverses himself and says, okay, now you can go ahead and apply it. So I look forward to the rest of the conversation. I think I'm out of time.